I think I told you guys about the time I wired my brother up to be shocked by electrical current from the car. Ran the spark plug to his seat. And every time I get wired up in these get-ups, I remember that. And I'm afraid that's going to come back to get me. I appreciate being here. Thank you for your presence this morning, not for my behalf, but for that of the Lord as we come together to be able to honor Him and to worship Him. This week we set aside a time, hopefully, that we can better understand the Lord. If you've ever wondered and ever thought about it, and if you've ever gotten to the point in your Christianity that you really ask hard questions, because honestly that's what it takes to grow, is sometimes just to ask questions that are something you shouldn't ask. You know, how am I really going to get to heaven? I mean, honestly. Have you ever thought about that? A lot of times that question will appear in people's head. And it's not just because they're a new Christian. You may have been a Christian all your life. And I know of people that evidently by the questions that they ask and the statements that they make, they've never really figured that out either, to be honest. Truly, there was a song written a few years ago, and I don't remember who sung it, but, you know, if they know half the things I've done, they'll never let me in. And, you know, oftentimes we get that idea. You know, if they... And see, then as Christians, we realize that God knows everything we've done. He's ever present. He knows all things. He's everywhere. So guess what? They are going to know everything I've did. They're going to know more than half of it. They're going to know it all. And so how is it that you and I are going to be able to step into the portals of glory, knowing the things that we've lived, the way we've lived, the things we've done? Even in our best, we still make serious mistakes. We still sin from time to time as Christians. And so this becomes a very hard thing to reconcile in the mind of humans. And that is how that we, in a sinful state, and even if you can abstain from sin, I'm assuming you guys are this way. I hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag on myself. But even if you can keep from doing that which is wrong, you still have the guilt of the fact that you really wanted to. And you just restrain from it. And see, this was the difference between the Jews who strove to abstain from doing things, but at their heart they really wanted to. And Jesus, when he came on the scene, he said, "A man that looks upon a woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery. If you hate your brother to the point that you'd like to murder him, you might as well have." I mean, it's all in the same. So Jesus points out to us that it's not just what we can abstain from doing that makes us righteous or unrighteous, but also our intent of our heart. So we find from our core as humans that we have a side about us. We have a propensity to sin. We have a sin nature. So we have to deal with that. And so as Christians, I think we have more problem with it than honestly the world does. Because before you became a Christian, I mean, everything was, at least everything coincided. I mean, your body wanted to sin, you was welcome to help it. But now we've got a struggle going on. We've got a problem that becomes very conscious to us. And that is the fact that we want to do well, but we find out we really have a hard time doing it. And some things we can overcome, some things we'll do better at, some things we will maybe completely lay aside. But then there's going to be always those things that will continually arise in your life to constantly remind you that you're just not, you know, what you would like to be in some form or another. So then let's go back and ask the question, how is it that you and I are going to go to heaven? How is it that I, Carly Connor, sins list as long as you can imagine, how is it that if God knows all those things that I'm going to be able to step through those pearly gates and enjoy an eternal bliss with my Creator when He is sinless, and the Bible tells me very plainly that He cannot commune with sin. So that's the purpose of our study this week. And I did this for a couple, actually, that I was studying with that were not Christians at all. They think they are, but they're not. So that's a difficulty within itself. So I devised this as simple as I possibly could in order to be able to try to get through to them, first of all, to shed light on the fact that they were not where they thought they were, but in order to give them an overall picture. And then my wife said, well, you ought to think about giving that to the church. And so I've been giving this on a Wednesday nights at Ashlock. And I've had some decent responses from it. Some people that, have been in church quite a while have told me that they've begun to understand some things they hadn't before. So my purpose this week is, first of all, to show you how you're going to be able to stand before a holy God when you're not, when you have the propensity and sometimes yield to sin, how you're going to be able to do that, how the Bible points that out for us very plainly. God went to great lengths to be able to explain to us and to show to us how that was going to go about. And so we're going to discuss that this week. But I'm going to put it, what you see on the screen is half of what we're going to discuss today. And we're going to have to do that very quickly in order to get through this in a timely manner. So what I've done is given you this timeline, and we'll see this timeline for the next few nights, and we're going to expound on this. So if you already know this, then that's great. I want you to be able to devise some sort of something on this same lines for yourself, even if it's in your mind, so that you can be able to help other people that don't know. Because oftentimes when we try to convert somebody, we want to tell them about the organization of our services. I mean, people don't know anything. I mean, they've never stepped inside the church door, and we want to start telling them about how we don't have Sunday school. Well, big deal. They're not even converted. So let's start from the ground up, and let's learn to get in a position to where we can teach people about God and who God is, and let's bring them to the truth, and then let's let them see the truth, instead of starting trying to put doctrine on them to begin with without them first having understood even what God is about. And so oftentimes the reason we fail to do that, I have seen, and I've seen it in my own life, is because truthfully we didn't really know it ourselves. We have just made it through life this far and through church this far, and we've just kind of adopted what we've heard and what we've talked about, and we've never gotten much further than that. And God has left within our hands the greatest kingdom that has ever been, the eternal kingdom, and He expects us as participants to prepare ourselves in order to be able to teach this to other people. So I have put in the simplest forms that I know how the Bible as a whole. Now, what you see on the board, and I guess I can just step around here, which would be simpler. I normally make copies of this and hand it out, but since y'all are fortunate enough to have PowerPoint, this works a little better. I still have copies of it. If you want to take some, I'll try to make some later this week and have copies of what we've got here if you want to take it for your own purpose and maybe expound on it and use it in your evangelistic efforts somehow. So from the very start here to the very end, In the biggest form that I know how to put the Bible, and if you just grasp this out of what we're going to talk about this week and you haven't grasped it before, maybe it'll help you. The first two chapters of the Bible deal with how God intended for His creation to be. You know, this will help you answer questions like, you know, how can there really be a loving God if you look out into the world and you see the mess that things are in? I mean, for real, people are starving to death in Africa and all over the planet. People are dying because they have the lack of necessities of life. You know, and how can God allow that to go on? How can God allow a little baby to die before it's ever born? Or how can He allow it to be murdered by people before it's born? So on and so forth. You know, and this is a viable question, especially if you're not somebody who struggles with trying to understand and follow the path that God would have us to. This is what pushes a lot of people to become an atheist. This is the premises of atheism. If there was a God, He would be a loving God, and you wouldn't see the creation in the shape that it's in. So, therefore, there must not be a God. They've come to that conclusion. Genesis chapter 1 and 2 tells you what God intended for the creation to be. So the next time that thought or that question is posed to you, then you need to remember Genesis 1 and 2. Because that's what God intended. Genesis chapter 3 will tell us what man did to the creation. Because of the rebellion of man, or the decision that he wanted to go his own way, Genesis chapter 3 through about 6 tells us how that happened and the repercussions of it. You know, there's always consequences to choices, whether they be good choices or bad ones. So Genesis 1 and 2 tells us what God intended. Genesis 3 tells us what happened as what? A result of God's hatred toward mankind? A result of an unloving God toward His creation? No. The result of a rebellious mankind. And so, there within three chapters of God's revealed Word, we already have, first of all, answers to many of our questions. The world is not what God intended. I heard a guy liken it to this. I enjoy cars, and I love old cars especially. But now you take somebody to a junkyard and look at this rusted, mangled heap of mess and say, I can't believe somebody would make something like that. And then you scratch your head if you've got any sense and say, that's not what they created. Let me show you a picture of this beautiful car when it was first created. This is what it was intended to be. This is what it became. So people stand and look at our world that we're in and the condition it's in and think, I can't believe somebody created this. So therefore, evidently nobody did. But you see, it's just like looking at the mangled piece of junk and thinking that that was how it was created. It was not. That's what it became, but that's not what it was created. So Genesis 1 and 2 will tell us how the creation is, what God intended for it. Genesis 3 will tell you why it is the way it is today. And, now this is the simplest I know how to put all this from the beginning to the end. So from Genesis chapter 3, primarily from Genesis chapter 9, but starting with Genesis chapter 3, you're going to see pictures in the Bible, word pictures. We're going to see examples. We're going to see historical events in the Bible that will show you how it is that God brought about this redemption. You see, He created us and we had perfect union because of rebellion. Do you understand what it means to reject life? Because you see, Christ said, I am the life, I am the resurrection. From God comes all life, and from God life is sustained. To reject life is to embrace death. You understand that? That's Genesis chapter 3. So, when mankind rejected God, he rejected life and therefore embraced death. Now, God stepped in as a result of this, and he begins to show us how it is that he's going to go about bringing back or redeeming. Redeem means to buy back something that was lost from you. And so throughout the rest of the Bible, the Old Testament at least, we're going to have these pictures. So now if you've ever picked up the Bible and you've read it and you think, I just can't get this. I don't understand what it's saying. It's so confusing. And I've heard so many people say that. I have stood in those same shoes. Not that I'm enlightened to the point that I know it all. But if you have ever picked up books such as the book of Romans, commonly referred to, that and the book of Hebrews, those two combined, commonly referred to as the hardest things to learn or the hardest things to grasp in the New Testament. You want to know why? Because they both deal with, Romans deals with redemption, how it is that you as a sinful person can stand before a holy God and not be condemned. Hebrews deals with the sacrificial systems and the priesthood of the Old Testament. And so the New Testament makes the assumption that you understand the Old. And therein lies most of our problem. We don't. I hear these comments all the time. And no reflection on nobody. And this fellow had been in the church for years, longer than I've been alive probably. He said, I just never read that old Bible. Calls it the old Bible. It's like when you get a new car, you know. The old one just falls to the wayside. It's no longer any good. You see, that's kind of what we thought about. That's the way we put it in perspective. Well, now we've got the New Testament. We don't need the old one anymore. That's not exactly the phraseology that should be used. The Bible is one continuation from the beginning to the end. It's a covenant. It's a promise that God made to man. The old one has been fulfilled. The promise has been fulfilled. You and I live now in respect of a better promise and another promise. Or a new testament or a new will. A different one. But the New Testament tells us that the Old Testament was a shadow of that which was to come. It was a tutor to what? Bring us to Christ. And so the Old Testament, in my feeble understanding and the best assumption I can make, is that the Old Testament seems to be a physical comparison of that which is going to be spiritual. Did you know that out of all the teaching that is recorded in the New Testament, or in the Bible of Jesus' teaching, which is found in the New Testament, 40% of it is done in parable form? 40% of it. And out of that 40% of it, about 20% of it deals with eternal damnation or the warning against that. But parable, as you already know, I'm sure, is you take something physical and you use it to explain something that is not, or something that somebody don't know about. We do this all the time in our speech. We try to explain things to children. So we try to grasp, figure out something that they can relate to and use it to compare to something that they can't. Well, Jesus did the very same thing. He took physical things in this world that people could relate to, and He used those to explain spiritual things. Now, the kingdom that you're going to see in the Old Testament was not the real thing. We'll get to that a little bit later on in the week. The Israelis that you see that's on the Mediterranean shore now, the kingdom of Israel, they were not the real thing. Oh, this has stirred up all kinds of confusion in the world in which we live today. This is why we have, there is policy made in the United States based on the fact that Israel, that is Israel on the Mediterranean Sea, is God's people. And that Jesus is coming back there one of these days to set up rule in His kingdom. There is policy made in the United States based on that. Nevertheless, you get the idea, people get the idea, and it has been built upon that because that was a real kingdom or a physical kingdom, that it was the real thing. Well, I'm here to tell you today, it was given to us that we might be able to see when the kingdom, the real kingdom came about, that we could understand what it was. If you think I'm wrong in what I just told you, go back to Daniel and look where the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw. Remember the head of gold and however it went from that point on, I never can remember. He says in the days of the last kingdom, which we know to be the Roman Empire, He said God will establish what? His eternal kingdom. Now, wait a minute. If you take the idea that Israel was the eternal real kingdom, then they were in existence when that was written. And Daniel says that in the time of that fourth kingdom, which was the Roman Empire, he says God will establish His eternal kingdom. That's you and me. We're the eternal kingdom. We're the real thing. Israel was just the prop given to help us to understand what we are. Because how am I going to stand before you today and tell you what the priesthood is all about? What it is that God would have us to do as a priest? Or what our high priest is all about? What a sacrifice is for? You see, Christianity is the only religion in the world that has God giving to mankind the way to get to Him. Every other religion, bar none, has man and his ideas of how he's supposed to get to God. Oh, the Buddhist says that you're going to be reincarnated, and the worse you live, the worse you're going to be. You may come back as a fly if you didn't do too well. You know, you may come back as something a little more prominent if you lived a pretty good life. But you're going to be reincarnated over and over until you can do enough good deeds to be accepted. You see, that's man's idea of how to get to God. But you see, we're going to look this week at how God gave man, not man trying to get to God, but God trying to get to man. And we're going to see how He went about that, and He gave us Israel. Not the Israel that we are. We're the real Israel. We're what God had in mind before He ever created the foundations of the world. We are the church, the eternal kingdom, the one that never will cease to be, the one that is in a spiritual state rather than a physical state. So in order to help you to be able to understand that, God has went to very painstaking measures to be able to help us to see that. And so He did that through about a 1,000-year period of time with the nation of Israel and with a tabernacle or a temple, a place of worship. We're going to look at all that as we go. So in the Old Testament, or that behind the cross, we'll say, we have all these examples. We're going to look at some of those examples as we go through this week, and then we're going to finish up in the tabernacle itself and look at its significance. And it points every direction imaginable. The pathway to God, it tells us who Christ is. It tells us about His nature. It tells us about God and His redemptive power. It tells us about me as a priest, you as a priest, believer priest. We've been made that way through the blood of Christ. What is blood? Why does the Bible splash with blood from the beginning to the end? Have you ever wondered about that? I had an atheist tell me one time. He said, "I've read your Bible." He said, it's the bloodiest thing I've ever seen. You know, I didn't know what to say to him at the time. I thought, well, it is, but I've never really thought about it that way. It's kind of a gory book. I've had Christians tell me that. It's a gory book. You know why it's gory? It's gory because of that right there. Genesis chapter 3. It takes a life of something to stand in your place for you to be able to stand before this holy God. So we'll see how that works throughout this week. So why is the New Testament different than the Old? Why is it that we can feel that we just lay the Old Testament aside and we're done with it and we never have to look at it again? Because now we've got the new one. The plan for the redeemed. You see, the Old Testament gives us examples of how God is going to redeem His people. Very painstaking examples. Some of them took thousands of years to bring about and to bring into fruition. And so, then on this side of the cross, why do we live differently than those before? You know, you've got some people out there that try to serve Christ and say that you have to marry the two of them together. You had people in the New Testament. They followed Paul everywhere he went. Oh, well, yeah, you can be a Christian, but you got to be circumcised and you got to follow the law. You see, those are called Judaizers. You find them in the New Testament. They've been around all this time. And they say, well, you got to marry the two together. Seventh-day Adventists, same thing. So they believe, they've tried to marry Christianity. You know why? Because they've never understood the Bible. They've never understood that there is a breaking point. There is something that we look forward to and something we look back toward. So the reason we live differently is because after God redeemed mankind, then we live as those that are redeemed. You see? We're part of the real thing now. We're part of a spiritual kingdom that it took God, or that He took, 1,000 years to explain. So that we wouldn't miss the point. And I'll be if we hadn't missed it anyway. We scratch our head wondering what Israel really has to do with this world. And is God really coming back over there? And there is, I don't know of a denomination, and I can be wrong, but I don't know of a denomination that doesn't buy into premillennialism. That meaning that the kingdom hadn't got here yet. And that Christ is going to come back someday and establish it. I don't know of one that doesn't buy into that. The Bible does not teach that. The Bible teaches us that the kingdom came at the cross. And we're it. But you see, as Christians sometimes, we don't understand that. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it's gone. I mean, if you really look at it from a worldly standpoint or without understanding even, I mean, Israel was in existence for 1,000 years. The Roman army destroyed them. Well, the United Nations back in 1948 finally got them reestablished over there. So it looks like they're coming back. Maybe this is right. Maybe they were the real thing. We never have got it. Or a lot of people haven't got it. We're it. We're the real thing. We're what God intended. But you look around and you think, can't really see it. I mean, you'll see anybody living like they're in an eternal kingdom. I shouldn't say anybody. But as a majority, I mean, I get to go different places and get to see different people. And you don't ever get to see many people on fire about anything. I mean, we just kind of do our thing, you know, just drudge along. Sunday, let's go get that over with. I heard one guy say that. We're standing on the church porch, and it was time to go in. And he says, let's go get this over with. You know? They don't tell how many people thought that, just didn't say it, you know? So anyway, in our simplest form, God's intent for the creation, the results of man's rebellion, then God spends the rest of the Old Testament telling us how, or giving us pictures on how He was going to bring about the redemption of mankind. At the cross, that was done. And then after that, we've got a different way of living because we're a different group of people. We're a spiritual kingdom. We're the one that God talked about. We're the one that was promised. We're the one that never will end. I hope you know that your eternal salvation that you received upon baptism and the adding of the blood of Christ, eternal life started for you back then. Don't think that once you die and get to heaven, eternal life has started. It's here and now in your life. So the problem with it is we've got to learn how to live that way. We've got to learn to live like we are who we are. And so that's what we're going to do this week. Now this is the second half of that, and we're probably going to run out of time. We'll have to kind of hustle. So now I've just gone back and I've kind of expounded on what we just talked about. The first line was just as generic as you could get it. four basic ideas about the Bible. Genesis 1 and 2 tells us what God had intended and how it was originally created. Genesis chapter 3 tells us man's rebellion. Genesis 6 through 9 tells us the culmination of it, destruction of the world as it was. And then we see pictures, or many of them, and it can be expounded on seemingly endlessly, of God's plan for His redemption, or that is to bring mankind back to the position that he was before, and that is in a relationship with Him. And so then, of course, at the end there, we live as we're redeemed. So Genesis chapter 1 through 6 tells us that the old world was destroyed. Peter, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5 tells us that the world was destroyed and overflowed with water. And that is, of course, an entire picture from beginning to end. You're reading Genesis chapter 4 and 5 and 6 that the world had gotten to the point that it was so wicked. But you want to, you see, sometimes I think we read that and we miss the point of why he told us that. Do you know why the world got so wicked and how it became that way? He tells us in the first part of chapter 6 that the godly unmarried the ungodly. The sons of God took to them daughters of men, all that they chose. So the destruction of the world that first came is a result of what? Not treading the path that God had made for us. So, if you want to wonder what's going to happen to the world as we are, then there's going to be a point that we get to the point that we're in that condition again. And God waited as long as He possibly could. He had one man that was left in that righteous lineage that was willing to carry on and do as God had asked him. And so it had to be destroyed. It wasn't a choice. It was forced destruction. And so God wiped it out and He started the world over again. You'll find that in Genesis chapter 9, starting with Genesis chapter 9 through chapter 11. You'll find where He started the recreation of the world as we know it today. And so in Genesis chapter 10, you're going to find what is referred to as the Table of Nations. We'll get on past all these details and we'll get into something to you in a minute. But there's some answers to some of your questions here. Because I've had people say, well, how do you get black people and how do you get white people and how do you get red people and brown people and so on and so forth? Where does all that come from? And then you have humanists or people with this evolutionary mindset and they'll say, well, it's because, you know, peoples evolved differently and so on and so forth. And you got that answer. And then various others. But the reality of it is, in Genesis chapter 10, the Bible tells us because of mankind. See, the ark landed on Mount Ararat and then people began to clutter together again. So God says that as long as they stay together, they're going to stir up all kinds of mischief. You know, you can have a young'un, pretty good kid. You can bring one or two of his friends over and they're going to tear up the house. You see, they're just that way. And God knew that and He used that example. So He began to spread us out and keep us separated so that the mischief didn't develop hardly so quickly. Well, we're a global community these days. You know, we know what happens in every corner of the earth. That spells trouble. And you can already see that. But nevertheless, in Genesis chapter 10 is what's referred to as the Table of Nations, and that's where all these people went. You know why they went? Well, Genesis chapter 11 tells you that. Because of the Tower of Babel. God confused their languages, and so they separated out in language based in their language. Now, you guys ever fool with animals, thoroughbred, you know anything about them? You know, you've got the lineage of dogs, cats, whatever, cattle, horses, you know, thoroughbred means they're pure line. They have been bred to animals just like them, and the best of the animals just like them. And so when you do that, you get certain traits. If you want a milk cow, you breed cows together that typically give a lot of milk, and so you end up with a Jersey or a Holstein. You want beef cattle, you breed the ones together that has the best yield in beef, and so you come up with Black Angus, or you come up with whatever. Dogs, you get a German Shepherd. They were bred into existence about 1830 or 50-something, and so they didn't always exist. They were bred into existence because of some traits about them. Now, you separate people off into groups, and you're going to have certain traits come to the surface. And so we get people with dark skin, and we get people with light skin, and we get people with slanted eyes, and we get people with dark hair and dark eyes, and we get people with blonde hair and blue eyes, and black hair and blue eyes and green eyes. And that's how you get that. All because of Genesis chapter 10 and 11. So, no, Africans are not some sub-race. I've heard that said. That they have just not evolved to the point. You wouldn't believe people that think these type of things. It's because people were separated and genetics, isolated genetics, brought to the surface certain traits. And so that's how we are where we are. So that was a way to explain to your kid the next time they ask you, Mommy, why are some people black and some people yellow and some people so on? Don't give them an answer other than what's related to the Bible. Take them back and show them. God separated people out. And then that's how they became. So, now here's the point we want to make in this last part, in the last few minutes. Genesis chapter 12, correct me if I'm wrong, from Genesis chapter 12 through the rest of the Old through the rest of the whole Bible, but through the rest of the Old Testament especially, we're dealing with one family. Only one family. And so, time goes on, the Bible continues to be written, thousands of years are passed by, but from Genesis chapter 12 to the cross. But you see, this will simplify things for you. Because we tend to get into the details and never really figure out the big picture of what's really going on. We end up with a lot of pieces to a puzzle. You ever tried to put one of those puzzles together without the picture on the front of the box? That's so much help, ain't it? You see what it's supposed to be, so you, in a result of that, you arrange those pieces in accordance to that. You know, so many times with the Bible, we've just got all these parts and pieces and little fragments, and we don't have a clue where they go. We never have had a picture in order to show us this is where that goes, and this makes the picture clearer for me. And the more of those pieces you can hook together, the closer you get to understanding what it is you're doing and forming a whole understanding of what God would have us to know and what He would have us to do. So, from Genesis chapter 12, basically through the whole Bible, but certainly up until the time of the cross, we're dealing with one family. And that family is the family of a man named Abram. His name was changed to Abraham. So, after Genesis chapter 12, bar a few things, I mean Job and so books like that, but for the most of it, it's dealing with one family. So, God pulls out a man, and He says, I'm going to bring this Savior through you. We know all about that. Most of these things we're going to talk about this week, you'll have to take what you've already learned and hook it to what I'm going to try to tell you. But that's my purpose, and I hope it's going to help you to be able to bring some things together. So the focus is on Abraham and his family throughout the rest of the Bible. That will make sense to you when you begin to understand that you and I are what? Adopted into the family of God. You see, I wasn't born an Israeli. I wasn't born in lineage with Abraham. So when the New Testament talks about us being adopted, then you'll understand what it's talking about. You see, that makes sense to you when we're talking about this one family. So we all become one family. I was adopted into that family. I don't really belong there. I mean, I get the benefits of the greatest family. That is the family of God. And that family brought about by the new creation, which is the church, and Christ being the first of that. He's our eldest brother. We call each other brother and sister in church. Why do we do that? You ever wondered? This is why. We're all part of the same family. You and I being adopted into that family, we're not born. Every person that's ever been, save Christ, has been really adopted into that family, because in order to be born in that family, you'd have to be born and stay sinless, and we're not. So we have to be adopted. So this family becomes a powerful kingdom. That's what we're going to look at. And that kingdom, through that kingdom, shows us how God has laid out a plan for us to be able to get to Him. We don't have to struggle. We don't have to wonder. We don't have to scratch our head and think this or think that. We have the plan. This is what you do, step by step, to be in My presence and to be accepted in My presence. So if you've ever wondered how you're going to cross that threshold into heaven, if you're ever worried about the gates being shut and you being kicked out, then you don't have to wonder. You may have to be concerned whether you're going to do what it takes to make it or not. But it's not God's fault. It's not everything that can be done has been done. The rest of it lies within your choices. So that part you might wonder about. But I can tell you the other. So that family becomes a powerful nation, and this kingdom is a shadow of the real kingdom yet to come, which is the church. So that's all behind the cross. And so we're going to look extensively at Abraham's family tonight and how that works and where they bring them to. And we're going to follow that family because that's what the Bible does. From Genesis chapter 12, the Bible follows that family through on out. And of course, Christ being the super, super great, however many times removed, grandson of Abraham. So you see, the Bible is about representation. If you've ever wondered how it is, again, that you're going to be able to stand before God when you know good and well that you have made mistakes in your life, and those mistakes is what separated you from God in the first place. You have state representatives? Well, I don't know how well they represent us, but nevertheless, that's what we call them. You see, I can't go to the state legislature in Nashville. All of us can't go down there. So we elect a man that's supposed to carry our values, and he's supposed to go down there and do that for us. So when he stands there, it's the same as, supposed to be the same as me standing there. And all of Tennesseans standing there, representing the ideas of the people. So that's what I'm talking about. The Bible is a picture of representation. Someone else representing other people. So we're going to see that primarily Wednesday night through Friday night. But so this kingdom that Abraham becomes, this physical kingdom, this Israel, kingdom called Israel of the Old Testament, is going to show us in great part that. Now, on the other side up here where we had our redeemed, the people that have been redeemed, remember we had people that, how God was going to redeem people, pictures of that in the Old Testament, and then we had those that are redeemed. We got to learn to live like we're redeemed. This is how we do that. The new creation, you see, there was an old one. Then there was a new one. If you want to call it new, it's refurbished. It is what's left of the other one. But the real creation is that of us, that of the church. And Christ being the first of it. Jesus is the first of this new creation, so tells us in Colossians 1 and 15. This is the creation that's being talked about. It's not the physical one that you can see and lay your hands on. You see, we get the idea that if I can feel it and touch it and knock on it and see it, that it's real. And anything that I can't see is not. Well, it's just reverse. This won't be here probably in 100 years. Certainly won't be in 1,000 years if that has lasted that long. Nothing will be, including any of us. So it's kind of reverse. That's why we lay so much importance on things of this world and things that we can get and things that we can hold and things that we can see. Because we feel somehow within us that's real things. And it's not. But sometimes we give a lot of our time and effort for that. So Christ is the first of the new creation. You and I are added as a result of that and by His grace. In Christ we also become part of this new creation. Here's a couple of verses if you want to write them down and read them to you. We're out of time, so I'm not going to. 2 Corinthians 5 and 17, Galatians 6 and 15 tells us that as a result of what Christ has done, which we'll tie all this together. I'm not leaving you hanging. I'm just trying to give you an overview of what we're going to be looking at and simplify it in a way that you can hopefully understand the Bible as a whole. Because if you don't ever get any more than what we've talked about today, I hope that it'll enlighten you in your understanding of the Bible. So when you go back and you read in some of the Old Testament, it's talking about Israel and the prophets of Israel. Who's he talking about? Israel was a great grandson of Abraham. Or maybe a grandson. I'll have to go back and count that. But that's his family. So this people that becomes a nation, this is who we're talking about. Abraham. So Abraham's family multiplies to the point that there's enough of them that they become a nation of people. And a great nation of people. And that great nation of people God used to show us what we are in Him. And what it is that we're doing. How it is that we serve. What a priesthood's like. What sacrifices are about. We're going to see that, you know, extensively as we go on through the week. So, bear in mind, you and I are part of this real creation. It's a physical or a spiritual one. And so, you look out into the world and you can't see it. And you have to scratch your head sometimes and you think, really? Is it real? Can it be real? Is this just all a figment of my imagination? I mean, I was raised in the church. I have never known anything different. Do I think what I think just because I've always been told that?
I mean, I have never seen the kingdom. I mean, I've never been able to lay my eyes on it. Other than you folks. But I mean, that may be a figment of my imagination. It may be the propaganda that I have bought into. So what are we really doing? And is what we're really doing the real thing? Yes, it is. Because God gave us a kingdom of people in the Old Testament for us to look at and explore. And if you ever want to know about yourself or what it is that you're doing, then you go back and you look and you read. And you'll see how God deals with His people. You'll see that He doesn't tolerate people in His kingdom that are not the way they should be. He helps those that are willing to change. He will give guidance to those who are willing to seek it. And you'll see all of God's characteristics, including His wrath, in the kingdom. The physical one. Not the real one, but the physical one. And then you and I get to enjoy the real thing. That's why Jesus said that the prophets long for the day to see what those people standing there saw. They taught of and longed to see the coming of the Savior. Of course, the Jews misunderstood Him. They thought He was going to be a king. I mean, this idea of this Christ reigning in a physical kingdom is nothing new. His disciples thought the very same thing. They said, when you get to your kingdom, who's going to be the greatest in your kingdom? In other words, I'm sure it's going to be me, because you don't ask for the guy next to you. You see, they had the idea that it was going to be them, because they had the idea that He was going to sit on a throne in Israel, vanquish all of their foes. But that wasn't the case. They soon come to understand that. So that's the purpose of our study this week, is to help us to understand who you are, what you are, what it is that we're out to do, and then hopefully to be able to encourage us to get about doing just that. And so we're part of the greatest kingdom that's ever been, established by God, one He says will never end. And it won't. So whatever it is that we love to do in the kingdom, we'll get to do something like that, I'm sure, throughout eternity. And so the more we enjoy, the more we participate, because this is a participation thing, then the more we'll learn to appreciate and the closer to God we'll be. That's our study for today. Tonight we'll continue to expound on the same type of things that we're looking at. We're going to look at the family of Abraham, how it is that they became this great nation of people, and then how God began to use that nation to show the nations of the earth and to leave in written form for us to be able to see who we are as His people and His intended kingdom. That's our lesson for today. We always extend an invitation song for those that might be in need of the services of the church, whether to either prayers of the church for guidance, for direction, for whatever your concerns may be. If you're not part of the kingdom of God, then if not today, then throughout this week, take and think about the things we talk about. We'll try to teach you what it means to have the blood of Christ covering you. We'll try to teach you what it means to be a priest. A priest is somebody who goes to God on behalf of others or goes to others on behalf of God. So if you've ever been asked to pray for anybody, then those folks realize, unknowingly or not, that you had the benefit and the ability to go before God on their behalf. And that makes you a priest. That's what a priest does. So we've got to learn to live more like what we are. And you can't live that way unless you know what you are. So this week we'll explore that. If we can help you to add you to the kingdom, that is, God does that for you, we'll show you how to do that. We'll show you how to apply the blood of Christ. But baptism is where that begins.